This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our subject for the weekend is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. Our study leader is Brother Roger Lewis of New Zealand. This is session number two, entitled Overview of Events Subsequent to the Return of Christ. Brother Roger.
Well, in our first session then tonight, and I realized that during that time there were people coming and going, so let's just have a quick summation for those that missed just the early start. We really commenced by a review of the framework of Bible prophecy, just to remind ourselves that the foundation of the whole structure of prophecy, we believe, is based upon Genesis 3:15, and that seed of the woman, seed of the serpent, blue line, red line controversy that begins in Genesis is indeed going to run right through to the end of time. And the book of Revelation tells us that that is so by deliberately taking up, by virtue of the guidance of the Spirit, the very terms and language of Genesis to show us that this controversy is a continuous enmity down through time. And why we wanted to stress that at the beginning was to suggest that even Ezekiel 38 can be helpfully seen on that framework. In fact, one of the most interesting things you can do is to take the red line and the blue line and plot some of the great prophecies at the time of the end and see how they might all outwork in the context of that controversy. That's certainly what we're going to do with respect to Ezekiel 38 over the course of this weekend. So our second session tonight is just a brief review of events subsequent to the return of Christ. And although most of you will be familiar with this, I really just want to point out a particular thing that I think is relevant in this context, and that's this, that this epoch of time, from the moment Christ returns to the establishment of the kingdom, is a time that we might describe as the epoch of divine judgment in all the earth. This preeminently is the epoch of divine judgment. If there's one characteristic word that I think summarizes this period of time, which we customarily describe as events subsequent to the return of Christ, those events which occur immediately after Christ's return, leading up to and into the establishment of the kingdom, this epoch is all about judgment. That's the crucial idea. Now, let me show you why that is, and it's linked to the seed of the serpent, seed of the woman idea, really. Do you remember how we concluded our last session? And that was that in the controversy of Revelation, we're told that at the time of the end in Revelation chapter 20, that the serpent power has one last rearing back of its head, as it were, as it tries to overcome the seed of the woman. One last bid for freedom. One last thrust of its power before God finally extinguishes it forever to show the justice of why it is that he has insisted that the flesh must be put to death. That controversy, of course, is played out in our own lives, isn't it, as we follow our Lord Jesus Christ. Every day in living the atonement, we put the flesh to death, we bring the spirit to life. And by doing that, we declare the righteousness of what God said at the start of this controversy. Well, that putting to death, that execution of judgment upon the seed of the serpent community is actually what this epoch of time is all about. And some of you will be aware that Brother Thomas, I think, helpfully suggests that that power of sin manifested in the seed of the serpent community is manifested ecclesiastically, is manifested militarily, is manifested politically, and that every one of those aspects of the seed of the serpent power have all got to be dealt with at the time of the end. The political manifestation of seed of serpent thinking, the military manifestation, the religious manifestation, all have to be dealt successive death blows in the successive work of divine judgment that might extinguish finally the seed of the serpent power, at least sufficient to begin the kingdom age, and finally beyond. So what we're going to have, therefore, in our study on Ezekiel 38, as we said, is that although Ezekiel itself as a prophecy was written somewhere back here before the coming of Christ, that if we were to take this as a 7,000-year timeline, we've got somewhere here Ezekiel 38 being outworked in the enmity between the two seeds. And it's part of this epoch of divine judgment in the earth. So here it is, in brief. Now, I just want to make a point about this. I'm not suggesting that this is an exhaustive list of events subsequent. You'll immediately spot some gaps. So it's not intended to be exhaustive. Secondly, you might want to argue about the sequence, because as you'll be aware, when we discuss the sequence of events that occurs at the time of the coming of Christ, you could argue, couldn't you, that some of them overlap. Some events are happening, in fact, simultaneously with other events. So you could argue where you might put them, were you to actually list them sequentially, you could argue which one comes first. So we're not going to get too worried about that for purposes of tonight. Tonight's more so that I can just suggest to you a theme, very briefly a theme. And the moment I do it, you'll see it. But maybe you've never seen this epoch of time represented in this way. In fact, but before we do that, I might just get you to turn up one Bible passage, and that's this, in Isaiah 26. And maybe this sets the scene for our overview of events subsequent to the return of Christ. The record says in verse 8 of Isaiah 26, "Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee." Now, who's that, by the way? And the answer is that those who speak in verse 8 are part of the seed of the woman community, aren't they? They're described in verse 2 as the righteous nation which keepeth the truth, which is another phrase for the seed of the woman. The righteous nation which keepeth the truth. They come in at the time of the end. Well, it's these who say in verse 8, "Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee." Now, what does that mean? In the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. In other words, what the seed of the woman is saying is that right down through time, in the course of their life, they've all waited in anticipation of this one epoch of time to come, the time of God's divine judgments. We've waited. We've waited in and for the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, to come. Not just upon us, but upon the nations. It says in verse 8, "The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the remembrance of thee." And Rotherhams translates that phrase, "Unto thy name and unto thy memorial was there a longing of soul." Unto thy name and unto thy memorial, because the divine name expresses the memorialization of God's intention. He who will be manifested in a multitude of mighty ones is God's name to say that one day he'll be enthroned in the blue line, in the seed of the woman community who will triumph everywhere. That's God's name, isn't it? It expresses that ultimate purpose. We've waited for that. We long for that. We wait in the way of thy judgment. This is the cry of the blue line seed of the woman community. Isaiah 26, verse 8. And this is what they cry for. Verse 9. "With my soul have I desired thee in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me I will seek thee early. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. Let favour be showed to the wicked, yet he will not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of Yahweh. Yahweh, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see and be ashamed for the envy at thy people, at the people. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them." Or as the New International Version says, "Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them." So here is the day of God's judgments in the earth. And that's the epoch that we're going to deal with right now. And the cry of the seed of the woman community down through time is that Yahweh might move to vindicate his name, to triumph. How's that all going to happen? He's got to establish his judgments in all the earth. It's the only way, he says. It's the only way, they say. Only then will the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. Show them favour, they won't listen. Leave them in the land of the upright, they'll never learn. Only by the imposition of divine judgment will the nations finally be subjugated to the divine will. That's the story of the seed of the serpent down through time, isn't it? Unless it's subjugated, it cannot be controlled. Now that, incidentally, is the very antithesis of the humanistic world that you and I live in today, which says, no God will save us. The destiny of the planet hangs in the balance in terms of our lives. Unless we recycle, unless we conserve energy, unless we save the whales, the planet is at risk. And isn't it interesting how that sort of endless, relentless message about being, you know, eco-friendly, energy-efficient people filters even into the Christadelphian community, that we also, in measure, need to save them. Not that I'm saying, by the way, that we ought to be litter bags or that we ought to be, you know, that we ought to act inappropriately, but it's not our job to save the planet. God's going to intervene, says Isaiah 26. There is no other way. Only when God's judgments are in the earth will the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. We can't do it. The seed of the woman need to be empowered by divine intervention. If this hostility, this enmity is ever going to be brought to a resolution, we can't do it. We've lived in our lives and experienced that enmity. So is every generation of the seed of the woman before us. Only when God intervenes will the controversy be brought to an end. When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. And I believe that that's what this epoch of time is all about. Now have a look at it now, events subsequent, from a thematic perspective. So here it is. So here's an overview of events subsequent. Well, it starts, of course, with the return of Christ to the earth. Now we're going to have the red line, blue line brought into focus in terms of the judgment of this line, the blue line, against the red line, because now there is the power of God, the righteous judgments of God might now be brought to bear on the face of all the earth. Now, if you were to just, before I do this, if you were to talk to me about events subsequent, what would you say has to happen between the return of Christ and the coming of the king, the establishment of the kingdom? So, resurrection? Yeah, happy with that? Anything else? Judgment of saints, all right? Yeah, happy with that? Judgment of the saints. Yep, anything else? A marriage of the Lamb, yes. I'll make that sort of part of that. So marriage of the Lamb follows the judgment of the saints. Yep. The what?
Destruction of a portion of Israel.
A destruction of a portion of Israel. You mean in what particular context are you saying?
This prophecy about a certain percentage of people who live in Israel being killed off.
Yeah, Zechariah 13, 2/3 of the nation should be cut off and die. Interestingly, this is digression, by the way, so we shan't digress because, you know, digression's very interesting, aren't they? You know the word two-thirds shall be cut off. Do you know what that word two-thirds means in the Hebrew? It's the word translated double portion elsewhere. A double portion is cut off because they are the firstborn of God. So they bear, the nation of Israel bears a firstborn responsibility to have obeyed God, and because they don't, they share the punishment of a double portion of them being cut off. Two-thirds are cut off and die. So that's an interesting line of investigation for you to follow through, by the way, that the two-thirds of Zechariah 13 is a double portion of punishment because the firstborn son of God has failed to live up to his responsibilities. And here's another interesting line of investigation. Do you know that a few years ago, the Time magazine had a very, very interesting article about Israel today, the state of Israel today. And I read this article. I wished I'd kept a copy of it. I guess I could probably, you know, Google it down or something, but in the middle of this article, jumping off the page and knocking you on the forehead was this remarkable statement that said, in the middle of this article, it said, in the terms of the mix of people in Israel today, it said, 2/3 are secular. So So I wonder whether that's the basis of the divine judgment to fall in Zechariah 13, that only one third of Israelis in the land today have any spiritual perspective, any relationship to the promises of Abraham, any sense of the heritage of that land as belonging to their forefathers. Don't you think that's the only third that God's probably interested in? And the other two thirds that are purely secular, God says, cut off. I have no place for them. That's a second line of interesting investigation. But we mustn't digress. But that's an interesting idea, isn't it? So, yes, so we'll talk about a destruction of part of Israel. Yeah, anything else? What else happens?
Fall of Babylon.
Fall of Babylon, yep. So fall of Babylon. Yep. Anything else? Work of Elijah, yep. Anything else?
Armageddon,
yep. That may be linked to that period of judgment on Israel, but that's fine. Armageddon. Anything else?
Gospel
to the nations. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, building of the temple. Yeah, anything else?
Smiting
and the healing of Egypt. Yes. Smiting and healing of Egypt. Yep, anything else? I've got room for one more. Remember, this is not exhaustive. So. You might like to add a final one, just to make sure the board was full. Now, that was pretty good. You know, off the top of your heads, that was pretty good. Now, let's compare that with my summary. You might find that, first of all, there's a pretty close connection. The only difference is that I've presented this thematically, and when you see it, you see it. What's this epoch all about? Well, the resurrection of dead ones. Yep. But that leads to the judgment and perfection of the saints, doesn't it? And if we were to say that this is a period of judgment in the earth, it begins with the saints. Now that's 1 Peter chapter 5, isn't it? For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begin at us, what shall be the end of them that know not the gospel? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? 1 Peter chapter 5. Remember those words? And so clearly what we're being told, actually it's chapter 4, isn't it? The stuff I stop and think about, it's chapter 4. Right-hand page, right column, top half, but it's chapter 4. And clearly what we're being told, and I think this is really vital, is think about it. Seed of the serpent, seed of the woman. You know, one of the controversies that we have in the brotherhood today is exactly the sequence of events. And some suggest that what happens is that before the resurrection takes place, that the Russian invasion of Israel has already occurred, and that overthrow takes place with the angels, and then later on the saints are raised to responsibility, and then they go out later on. Actually, I think that this is the start of the story. And I'll tell you why. Because after the saints have been judged and perfected, don't you think it's their primary responsibility to execute all the other judgments? Because they are the seed of the woman community. It's a controversy between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, not between the angels and the seed of the serpent. It's not the angels' job to execute this judgment, when you stop and think about it, is it? It's not their controversy, it's ours. So I think that one of the crucial things about the sequencing of events subsequent is that right at the start, we have the resurrection of the dead ones and the judgment and perfection of the saints. Judgment begins at the house of God first. Now let's see how that follows on. March of the Rainbowed Angel, which includes our smiting and healing of Egypt, doesn't it? So we've got that there. We've got the judgment and overthrow of Gog. Now, that's actually the Battle of Armageddon. We're going to try and prove that, by the way, in the course of our weekend. We're going to prove that the Battle of Ezekiel 38 is not separate to the Battle of Armageddon. It is the Battle of Armageddon. It's critically linked to all the other Armageddon prophecies. It cannot be dislocated or separated, which is one of the alternative views in the Brotherhood. I think we're going to convincingly prove that you cannot do that with Ezekiel 38. But I haven't described it as the Battle of Armageddon, have I? I've described it as the judgment and overthrow of Gog, which is actually the sin power manifested militarily at the time of the end. That's one of the blows against the seed of the serpent power. Think about it in that context, you see. This is part of the framework. Ezekiel 38 is part of the bigger story here that needs to be seen in that context. So we've actually got the resurrection, the judgment of the saints. We've got the battle of Armageddon. We've got the smiting and healing of Egypt. What about this one? The judgment and conversion of Judah. You know, one of the marvellous things that I think so wonderful about Scripture is that that very same war, that very same battle in Ezekiel 38 is not just the means by which the judgment and overthrow of Gog will occur. It's also the same means by which the judgment and conversion of Judah will occur, and that's the cutting off of two-thirds. Gog is the instrument by which this happens. But it wasn't God's purpose simply to punish Gog. It's his purpose to judge Israel. It's the first stage of God's judgment against his own people. That's what that battle is all about. And of course, how Zechariah chapter 13 finishes, it says right at the end that two-thirds are cut off and die, but the last part is refined and brought through the fire. And finally, at the end of that chapter, it says that they will say that Yahweh is our God, and I shall say, that's my people. I've waited for 2,000 years for them to say that Yahweh is our God and to confess their need of me. Now I can work with these people, says God. Only at the time of the end, and only when judgment has come upon them so that they've been humbled and converted, can the third that survives now be made use of in the purpose of God. Now we've got the Mid-Heaven Proclamation. Well, that was Brother Jed's comment about the gospel to the nations. That's Revelation chapter 14. Of course, it's described as the Mid-Heaven Proclamation because, well, that's the language of Revelation chapter 14. It's the angel flies between the heavens and the earth. So it's the Mid-Heaven Proclamation. It's the hour of God's... In fact, you know what it says? Fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come. So what happens after that? Well, we've got the work of Elijah. Did we have the work of Elijah? Yes, work of Elijah and the second Exodus. But what's the purpose of that? What happens during the course of Elijah's work in the second Exodus? Answer, the judgment and purging of Israel. Not Judah, notice, Israel. This is the two sides of the nation about to be brought back together. But there has to be the judgment and conversion of Judah, and also separately and independently of that, the judgment and purging of Israel before either of them can be brought back into covenant relationship with each other and with their God. And Brother Thomas suggests that there will be an actual celebration in the land when the house of Israel purged returns. There'll be a celebration that commemorates their being grafted back into covenant relationship with Yahweh their God, with their brethren from Judah at that particular time. So what else have we got in that period of time, in that epoch of time? We've got the judgment and destruction of the papacy. That's the fall of Babylon, isn't it? The judgment and destruction of the papacy. And by the time these ripples of God's work have rippled out, extended out to the four corners of the earth, doesn't it say in one place in the prophecy of Jeremiah, when it says, a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth, for Yahweh has a controversy with the nations, he will plead with all flesh. And the slain of Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other. And so, in fact, it isn't just the judgment and destruction of the papacy. In fact, it's the judgment and subjection of the nations in their totality that during this epoch of time are brought under the control of Christ and the saints. And then we've got, why, surprise, surprise, the building of the temple. And when that's happened, we've got the opening of the kingdom age. So that was a pretty good list that you provided on that board at short notice in terms of a summary of events subsequent. And all I've done is taken that list and reorientated, but you can see the key word. The judgment and perfection of the saints, the judgment and overthrow of Gog, the judgment and conversion of Judah, the judgment and purging of Israel, the judgment and destruction of the papacy, the judgment and subjection of the nations. When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants thereof will learn righteousness, says Isaiah 26. Well, there's the fullness of that prophecy now being outworked to the full extent of its detail. It's the epoch of divine judgment, is it not? And I think when you see it from that perspective, it's a very helpful way to understand what events subsequent's all about. Of course, you know what Brother Sully says. How does the kingdom age open? You ever know how Brother Sully suggests that the kingdom age opens? He suggests that it's the moment when the temple doors open. And I think not just the temple doors, but perhaps that special, unique door on the eastern side of the temple, which is opened once in fulfillment of Psalm 24, open ye the gates that the King of Glory might come in. And when that gate opens on the eastern side of the temple, it opens, Christ and the saints enter, shining in their glory, and the door shuts. And Ezekiel says it will remain shut for the next 1,000 years. That door stays shut. Christ and the saints have entered. And with the opening and shutting of that door, I think the kingdom age begins. And how the kingdom age begins is that the door's open, the temple's been built, the door's open, and who comes marching through that gate? Psalm 24 says it's the King of Glory. Isaiah 26, it says it's the righteous nation that keeps the truth that comes in through the gate. It's Christ and the saints. But give me another term, give me another description for that group. It's the blue line, seed of the woman, that marched through that gate. The gate's shut. The kingdom age has begun. The seed of the woman power is now in control. That's what this epoch of time is all about. It's not over yet. There's another 1,000 years of battle to go yet. But at least at the start of the kingdom, the seed of the woman is in control. That's what events subsequent is all about. That's what that epoch of time is all about. It's the seed of the woman community executing judgment right through the earth till the seed of the serpent power is so subjugated that God's will finally at least can be extended across all the earth in power and authority. Now, that's another interesting thought that goes with that. So let me just clear the board here, leave that screen up, which shows there. So what we've really done there is look at events subsequent, not so much focusing on the precise sequence as the theme. It's a thematic consideration. And the theme is, it's the epoch of divine judgment. Now, some of you will know, just in terms of putting this in another way, that's been brought down there sequentially. But let's do it this way now on the horizontal line. Because if we take the horizontal line, Brother Thomas suggests that if that moment there is the opening of the kingdom, so let's say the opening of the kingdom is at the end of this line that we've drawn here, a horizontal line, what's this moment here? The coming of Christ. So now we can take that sequential list of things and plot them on a horizontal line of time. Question. First of all, how long is that epoch of time?
50 years.
And Brother Thomas suggests 50 years. Anyone know why? Yeah. If you're going to be completely accurate, by the way, you should make it 49, because the Jubilee period is 49, not 50. That's a complete digression, really, but a very interesting one, but a Jubilee period is 49 years. I know it says the 50th year in the book of the law, but what you realise is that the 50th year, which is the Jubilee year, is also the first year of the next set of counting. It's like a week. A week's got 7 days. But the next day, which is the 8th day, happens to be the first day of the next cycle of 7, doesn't it? So a week's 7 days, not 8, even though the 8th day is the first day of the week. So a Jubilee year is 50 years, but it's the first year of the next cycle of 49. Jubilees are 49s. That's another whole study in itself. So I think it's 49. But let's make it 49-50, just in case you get confused. So Brother Thomas suggested that it's a Jubilee period. You know why he suggested a Jubilee period? Anyone know why Brother Thomas suggested a Jubilee period? Because he believed that the temple doors will open to mark the beginning of a Jubilee year. And he believed that because of a certain phrase in Ezekiel 40, which I won't go into now, but if you want to hear the clue to that, you've got to read Brother Sully's book on the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy. Hands up those that have read the book. Hands up those that ought to read the book. So the clue is in Brother Sully's book, all right? The temple doors will open in a Jubilee year. How amazing would that be? And if the temple doors open to symbolise the Jubilee year that begins the kingdom, then Christ comes exactly 49 or 50 years before that. I think that's a reasonable suggestion. And then Brother Thomas says, actually, we can break that 50 years into other sets as well, or other subsets. Anyone know what the subsets are that Brother Thomas breaks it into? Well, he breaks it into a subset of 10 years, which is probably not very accurate there. Let me just do that again. He breaks it into a 10-year subset. So, have I got that right? Would you say that's 10? 10, 20, 30, 40, probably is about there, isn't it? So, he breaks it into 10 years. And then he breaks it into another 10 years. Which means if that's 10 plus 10, then we've got to have here 30, is that right? And if we measured from here, we've got 40. So Brother Thomas says, in effect, well, actually, we could take this 50-year period and divide it into a 10 plus a 10 plus a 30 or a 10 plus a 40, and all of those are probably significant. The 10 years here is begun with not just the coming of Christ, but the judgment of the household. So here we are back here. Coming of Christ, resurrection of the dead ones, the judgment and perfection of the saints. See that word perfection of the saints? That's, I've erased it, haven't I? That's the marriage of the Lamb. You know how people say that the judgment will take 10 years? I'm not sure that the judgment itself will take 10 years, but I do think the judgment and perfection of the saints, including the marriage of the Lamb, will take 10 years. I think the judgment itself might take considerably less than 10 years. But that's not just the only thing that's going to happen in that 10 years. What's going to happen is Christ will judge the seed of the woman community, and having judged them, he'll now do this. Just imagine this. This is just so astonishingly exciting. He sits us all down and says, right, okay, those that are found guilty of punishment and worthy of punishment are sent forth. Now all that's left are the seed of the woman community that Christ has chosen. He says, now sit down, pay attention. And Christ now spends, I think, the bulk of that 10 years unfolding his blueprint for the takeover of the world. How we are going to totally revolutionize the world. And every single person's job in the seed of the woman community. So that by the time that 10 years are over, every single person that's part of that community marches forth knowing exactly what they've got to do, when and where and how. The marriage of the Lamb is Christ's opportunity to unfold the blueprint of divine covenant for the next 1,000 years of history. How exciting will that be? That's what that 10 years is all about. Now, what's interesting about that is Brother Thomas suggested that at the end of that 10 years, that there is a period of time that answers to the 10 days of judgment in the book of the law, where the day of trumpets was blown, which signalled what day which was to come. The day of trumpets blown, by the way, on what day of the year? Anybody know? Rosh Hashanah, which is what day? The first day of the seventh month. And what does the blowing of trumpets betoken that's impending in its approach 10 days later, the Day of Atonement? Okay, so basically what happens is that Brother Thomas suggests that this is the period of the marriage of the Lamb. This actually becomes the Battle of Armageddon. This represents the Midheaven Proclamation, saying you've got 10 days before the Day of Atonement arrives, so you better get ready. And you know what the Midheaven Proclamation says in Revelation 14? Fear God, because the hour of his judgment comes. And it's suggested that 30 years represents the 1 hour of Revelation 14. 30 years of divine judgment in the earth. And that 30 years of divine judgment in the earth is related to most of this work here. Judgment, 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 judgment. The hour of his judgment has come. And that epoch of judgment, as we said, is going to in fact span 30 years. But before that hour of judgment begins, and immediately after the Battle of Armageddon, another period begins, which is 40 years until the kingdom begins. What's the 40 years? And the answer is the 40 years is the second Exodus of Israel. And it occupies the same period of time, we believe, that the first Exodus takes of 40 years. So hidden inside this 50 years is that whole sequence of things broken into 10 plus 10 plus 30, which makes 50, which also makes a 30 and a 40 and a 10 and a 10. And every part of that is significant in terms of its outworking. Now, some of what Brother Thomas says is inferential, but it was biblically reasoned. Every part of it's biblically reasoned. And I think when you put all those ideas together, they all match exceedingly well, that in the wisdom of God, as usual, there's a whole multiplicity of things all occurring at the same time. God's judging the nations, God's judging Gog, God's overthrowing the papacy, God's delivering his own people, God's perfecting the saints. And because of all that, Israel's involved with 40 years, the nations are caught up with 30 years, the battle, the marriage of the Lamb is 10 years, the Day of Impending Atonement is a mid-heaven proclamation that lasts for 10 years, the Battle of Armageddon comes in the middle of all that. But actually, if you were to say what's the overall theme, it's the theme of the judgment of the blue line against the red line, because God has finally entered into the matters of the earth again and intervened in man's rulership to begin to establish his supremacy, that the blue line might triumph. So what are we going to do in the course of our study this weekend with Ezekiel 38? We're going to go zoom just into that line there, and we're going to take one tiny little snapshot, because on that line there, we're going to have Ezekiel 38, Joel chapter 3, Zechariah chapter 14, Daniel chapter 11, we're going to have a whole bunch of prophecies which are the Armageddon prophecies, and we're only going to zoom even on one of those at that one moment of time, but it sits in a bigger picture. That's useful to see, isn't it? So it's useful to see the context of Ezekiel 38, that the moment you start taking a prophecy all by itself, in isolation to the big picture that it belongs to, you may start to postulate ideas that don't fit the framework. Seeing something in its contextual setting is always helpful. So Ezekiel 38 sits just there in the line of the 50 years or the 49 years and sits fairly early on in the piece here, still in the land of Israel, because there's another aspect of this whole epoch of judgment is it's going to start in the land of promise, widen into the land of Babylon, and end up encompassing the whole earth, so that God's judgments are in every place before the kingdom age begins. So there's almost like a geographical layer to this sequence of events as well. There's a thematic layer, there's a time sequence, there's a geographical rippling out of God's influence via the seed of the woman community. Ezekiel 38 is just one spot in that story. Isolate it from that spot, and you might go wrong. Keep its contextual setting in perspective, and you'll see where Ezekiel 38 sits on the framework and you'll probably interpret it accurately as a result, because it's only part of a subset of a much bigger story. So I think I've done for tonight. Your caffeine obviously lasted because everyone's perked up remarkably well, but I think you've done very well. Thanks for staying right through to 10:45 tonight. And that sets the scene for getting into Ezekiel 38 in more substantive detail tomorrow.